you all for coming out tonight. I'm cold and wet, I think. Not as cold as it has been, but cold enough to still keep people away. What I'd like to talk about tonight is just a, you could say, an intuition that I have, and that to me has a lot of significance for the field of education. And that I have to admit I haven't completely figured out yet myself. So you might call this crowdsourcing in the sense that I want to put the idea out there and let you cogitate on it a little bit and come up with your ideas also. But I do want to talk a little bit about the sort of journey and the nature of the question that I have about education that really is the focus of this evening. A little personal history. I came out of Oberlin College not having had a pretty good education, but what we might call an education in fragmented knowledge. And I took the science of creative intelligence in 1974, and all of a sudden everything started to fit together. And that was when I first started appreciating the importance of wholeness. After that, I developed, for some reason, a burning desire to understand what knowledge was all about. What is knowledge? You know, who has it, who doesn't have it, how do you know when you have it, how do you know when you don't, and so forth. I took that with me into graduate school, and I started to read everything I could about what knowledge was, and it sort of transformed into an interest in meaning. What meaning was. In education, there are two kinds of learning. One is rote learning, that we're all familiar with. When we learn our times tables, we just memorize it. We don't know exactly what good it's going to be or how we're going to use it from that point forward, but we learn it, and that's rote learning. And there's a fair amount of learning we do in education that is rote. But by far the most interesting part of learning, and the thing that keeps us going as learners, is what we call meaningful learning. Learning where we are putting things together and things are starting to make more and more sense. And every time when we think we understand something better, it's because we've found greater meaning in the thing that we're looking at and that it's starting to make sense to us in a bigger way. And one of the things that really hit me in graduate school was reading Plato. And I put this picture on the screen here because this is a picture representing one of the greatest analogies ever written in Western thought. It's called the cave analogy. And it's what Plato describes in his Republic in about the middle of the book. And it's meant to describe or represent the nature of both ignorance and knowledge. It shows a group of people, you have to use a pointer here, prisoners they're called down here, who are chained so that they can only look in one direction at this wall. And on this wall are being cast a number of shadows. These shadows are being cast from people. I don't know what their role exactly is, but these people are walking by the parapet in back of the prisoners with different objects on their shoulders. And the fire that's right here is casting shadows from these sort of cutouts or puppets that then cast shadows on the wall here. And what the prisoners think is that this is what reality is here. This is what's going on in life. These shadows cast by puppets, which are created by the fire in back. Now, that, Plato thinks, is the nature of life in the waking state world, shall we say. And the only solution to understanding better what's going on in the world. And it's not that you can't understand anything here. If you follow it closely, like you follow a movie, you can figure out what some of these things are and what their relationship is with this other thing that almost looks like an animal chasing a man there or something. But anyway, here's a tree being represented by, you know, a shadow tree. But what the job of the teacher is, according to Plato, is to unchain the prisoner and gradually drag him up these stairs here and along this pathway out to the cave door here. And then out of the cave door, stepping into the sunlight. And the first thing, once you're in the sunlight, you can barely, because your eyes are so used to a much dimmer environment, you can barely make out the real tree here, and, you know, a pond and the objects around the tree and so forth. But eventually you can actually look at the sun, which is causing the image, which is enabling you to see this image here, I mean the real tree, and you begin to realize that in fact all of the objects of perception are in fact coming from the sun. The thing that struck me in graduate school was that what Plato was doing was essentially turning the tables on everything that we learned and knew growing up, when we thought that these things were real, and were later to find out that in fact this is real. In fact, this is also just a reflection of or a potentiality of the sun. So that the sun was what was real. And that transformation was the beginning of the answer, I felt, to what knowledge was, what meaning was. And then the other step that came about later was a tape I heard by Maharshi that was is no longer available on campus. Actually, I've been told that it's part of the teacher training tape collection, and that is off limits to everybody, apparently. Although we're trying to change that, we're trying to get some of these tapes back for research. But in that tape, Maharshi said that wholeness alone gives strength to the parts of knowledge. Now, there's another slide here to represent that. That was the title of the tape. And he went on to say in this tape that we cannot even know a part of knowledge without knowing the whole from which it derives its meaning. That to me was also a kind of aha, a clue, I felt, in understanding knowledge and meaning making. And so what I've been doing ever since is trying to understand these general principles in deeper and deeper ways. And what I wanted to do tonight with you was to give you an example of this from an area I know well. And that's important when you try to do research, you know. You have to start with an area that you know well and that you can study carefully and remember all the parts, because keeping in mind all the parts is really important when you're trying to understand something. And so I took a little poem. This was a poem that my mother loved, and my mother was the one really that started me on understanding and appreciating poetry. And I mentioned, or Paula mentioned before, that I went on to become an English teacher in high school, and so that was partly my mother's doing also. And what I wanted for the evening was something that was small enough so we could all wrap our minds around it, and yet rich enough so that we could begin to see the relationships between parts and wholes, and how, in fact, the whole may give sustenance to the parts. So I passed out for everybody. Hopefully everybody has a copy of the Ode on a Grecian Urn. And we run out? Yeah, we may have to share then if we don't have enough. But, you know, we're going to read it and in fact, maybe at the end we can read it together, which will be fun. But in any event, this is written by John Keats. And if you want to be really amazed, I'm going to tell you, how old do you think he was when he wrote this poem? Anybody know? Close. He was 23 years old. Written in 1819. He died at the age of 25 in 1821. So as we go through this, think on that. Talk about a meteoric rise of of a man in his life and his brilliance. John Keats was one like that. So, as with all poems and being an English teacher, I want to go through a few things first, which are by way of frame factors, we could call them, for understanding the poem. First, it's an ode on a Grecian urn. You probably could have figured that out. This is the best guess for the Grecian urn, which we think that it is about. It's now in the Louvre. As far as we know, Keats only saw it in a plate or a photograph in a book, but he was entranced enough with it that he made a tracing of it from the book. And you can see that it's made out of stone. I don't know if it's actually marble or not, but it could be marble. And it's, I don't know how tall it is, I'm not sure it mattered, but it's a substantial size. These actually were put in the middle of the floor of a Greek symposium, and you put water and wine in this to serve all of the guests. The greater the dilution of wine, the more cogent the talk was. You know. And it's not an urn to hold ashes, by the way, which some people have thought. So it's just an urn, and that's about all that we need to know about the urn, except that it's obviously got elaborate carvings on it. An ode is a sung poem. And so when we say ode on a Grecian urn, that's a singing of a poem, presumably. A few other important vocabulary pieces. In the third line, it mentions sylvan. For those of you who may not know, sylvan basically means wooded or natural outdoor kind of setting. Pipes refers to regular... like a flute, although a Greek ancient flute with multiple tones to it. Timbrel is a like a castanet or tambourine. Pastoral means also outdoor natural setting or wooded area. The only other thing that's kind of helpful to know is that Keats is a romantic, which means that he has a tendency in his poetry and all of his writing to sort of project his feelings into objects that he sees. He feels the world is a reflection of his own feelings and likes to see those feelings discovered in his environment. And that's probably all we need to say from the start. So let me just read through this once, because as every good English teacher knows, one has to enjoy first the poem and what it says before one does anything in the way of analysis. But we will do a little analysis because I think it will make the poem a richer experience for you, and we will come back after talking about it a little bit to read it again. So, Ode on a Grecian Urn. Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian, who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme, what leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape, of deities or mortals or of both, in Tempe or the dales of Arcady? What men or gods are these? What maidens loath? What mad pursuit? What struggle to escape? What pipes and timbrels? What wild ecstasy? Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on, not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth, beneath the trees thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever can those trees be bare. Bold lover, never, never canst thou kiss, though winning near the goal, yet do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not thy bliss, forever wilt thou love and she be fair. Oh, happy, happy boughs that cannot shed your leaves, nor ever bid the spring adieu. And happy melodist unwearied, forever piping songs forever new. More happy love, more happy, happy love, forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing human passion far above, that leaves a heart high sorrowful and cloyed, a burning forehead and a parching tongue. Who are these come to sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leadst thou that heifer, lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or seashore, or mountain built with peaceful citadel, is emptied of its folk this pious morn? And, little town, thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return. O Attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed, thou silent form, dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity. Cold pastoral, when old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man, to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know. So that's Ode on a Grecian Urn. And you might reflect for just a moment how much you understand of what you just heard based upon that reading. In other words, what's going on there? So the first thing we would do in unpacking what's going on, in searching for meaning and trying to understand, is to understand on a literal level. And the next thing we'll try to do is understand it on a more figurative level. And then the next thing we'll do is try to understand it on a more thematic, we could call symbolic level. And in those three levels, we'll understand new fabrics in the total poem. So let's just run through what's happening here, okay? Because that's the literal level. There are five stanzas. In the first stanza, we're introduced to a narrator who's looking at an urn. Simple enough. It's an urn that's carved. And he's asking questions. What is this, he's saying, basically, on the outside here? Are these men or gods or maidens? Why is one chasing another? Why is one trying to escape? What's this timbrels and pipes? What's the ecstasy that seems to be in the faces of the characters here? Second stanza, he's saying, he's talking about one part of the vase. Obviously, a vase has things on all sides. And so he's addressing the figures around the vase, talking to them, noting the opposites that are combined. That is, that they seem to be frozen in space, and yet they're all excited. There are leaves there that never turn brown and fall off. They're always fresh and always green. There's music and silence. There's a sensual and a spiritual side to the images there. And then there's the longing that is never satisfied but always alive. This is all in the images that he sees on the side of the vase. The third stanza is more contrast, but now it's more about sort of the two contrasts between the spring that's being depicted, and the fact that it is eternal, eternally spring, never to be, never to end, always to be warm, always to be excited, you could say. And then stanza four, a new set of figures is introduced. And this could easily have taken you by surprise because it's, first of all, it's on the second page, and second of all, there's no kind of anticipation there. All of a sudden, it's a new set of people coming to sacrifice. And you can imagine a parade, sort of people, which is leading a heifer, which is a cow. Cow doesn't sound as nice as heifer in English. And with silken flanks and garlands dressed, to be sacrificed. For what? To propitiate the gods, presumably, or something along those lines. And they're emptying out a town. So in the image, the town is now empty of people and will, as far as the poet's concerned, forever be empty. And that's another scene. So basically stanzas 2, 3, and 4 are all depictions of different scenes around the outside of the vision. The last stanza is now the narrator to talk about himself and what has happened to him as a result of viewing these different scenes around the vase. He's talking, starts to the vase first, Attic shade. The attic is, you know, part of Greece, and so he's calling the vase an attic shade. Fair attitude. Breed means braid. It's related to braid, an archaic term. In fact, a lot of archaic terms here make it a little difficult to understand. And that's referring to the raised characters and beads on the vase. And he says, you tease us out of thought. So you make us go beyond thought, as doth, in a similar way, to eternity. Thought about eternity takes us out of thought. And then cold pastoral, when old age shall this generation waste, when we die, thou shalt remain, and you will remain even in the midst of other trials and tribulations than ours. And yet you will always be, speaking to the vase, a friend to man. And now he's putting words into the mouth of the vase. He says, beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth, beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. So that's sort of a recapitulation very quick on the literal level. We could go into more detail about exactly what these things are referring to. Almost everything in the poem has a pretty clear and precise meaning, in spite of what you might think on first reading or first hearing. But basically, that's the story. It's five stanzas. The first stanza is a series of questions. The second through fourth stanzas are depictions of scenes which give... in which he describes what's happening there on one level. And then the fifth is what he's learned from the experience of looking at these different parts of the vase. So, that's the literal level. Let's take it to a figurative level. And here we'll do a little audience participation. Even before we go beyond the figural, before we go on the literal level, there's also what we call sound image involved in the poem, which is a series of emphasized and unemphasized syllables, as well as a variety of sonorous overtones and undertones in the poem. When you hear, for example, a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme, you see three Y's in that line. When you hear foster child of silence and slow time, the S's there are repeated. In fact, three S's there, foster, silence, slow. So there's both repeated consonants and repeated vowels, or repeated assonance of vowels, in numerous places in the poem, which we don't have time to go into. That's part of the sound, what we call the sound image, or in other words, the what our ear hears when we listen to the poem. But there's also the rhythm, the meter, that has a very specific thing. It has a kind of ebb and flow to it that is part of the literal level. So here's some definitions. Again, this is part still on the literal level. ode is defined as a lyric poem in the form of an address to a particular subject, often elevated in style or manner. You think this is elevated in style and manner? Rhetorical question. And written in varied or irregular meter, and you can see all of the derivations of it. And this is part, by the way, this is part of what we do when we create meaning. We have to understand the parts as well as the whole. But what I'm going to argue is that the parts really derive their meaning more from the whole than they do from the visuals, tactile world that we see. Here's the urn, but I think we've already talked about that. Here's the levels of meaning that I mentioned before. There's patterns at the literal level, that's basically the story, and patterns at the figurative level, that's basically the patterns of images and concepts, which we'll look at next, and then finally the symbolic level. If we look at the figurative level, let's do this together. I'd like you to go through the poem and first underline images or of words that remind you of silence or stillness. Okay? Just go through and underline images or words that remind you of silence or stillness. And you can circle, you can do this together at the same time. Circle images which remind you of sound or action. So, you may still be doing this, but I'm going to start going over a few of them. So, for silence, you probably underline foster child of silence and slow time. Slow time isn't quite silence, but it's slower than normal time. Ditties of no tone. Silent bee, not a soul to tell, so no point in talking. Silent form, dust tease us out of thought, that leads us to silence, I would say. Eternity, that could be silence or action, I suppose, but you could underline that. And then when we talk about action, you probably circle mad pursuit, struggle to escape, wild ecstasy, burning forehead and a parching tongue, trodden weed. And then when it comes to warmth, you have breathing passion far above, and probably some others as well that I didn't know. And then cold, you have cannot fade. That's not necessarily cold, but it's sort of cold. Cold pastoral, and cold eternity, maybe not cold. And then timelessness, there are a number of images there, but I don't think I even put them down. So you have more than eternity. Okay, so anyway, so what we see on the figurative level then is the mind moving back and forth, often between nearly opposite feelings, but it creates a feeling that pervades the whole poem. And it's going to be a combination of feelings, of silence and action, of warmth and cold, of timelessness and the immediate present. And that is what constitutes the figurative level and the feeling that you get when you read the poem. And that feeling is very crucial. The next level is the symbolic level. And in that, we see the urn represents visual art generally. It's a specific urn, but in fact, it represents all art, visual art. It represents eternity in the sense that it's going to last and outlast all of us. It represents beauty in the sense that it is a work of art that represents something that's moving to us. And the story around the urn represents the human condition, and it represents truth. In the sense of, it's trying to tell us something about the human condition, about about desire and time and timelessness and so forth. The ode itself is a poetic art, and it's the everlasting song in the same way that the vase is an everlasting image, because his poem that he is creating is itself eternal. We are reading it today, and it will be read hundreds of years from now. The narrator, you could say, is representing humankind and the ever-changing. He knows that he's going to be gone after this poem is still around. And then the priest is, you could say, a messenger from the divine, or in some way representing the divine, just as the cow or the heifer represents the earthly aspect. And so, and there are other symbols in here too, but the point is that at this level, things take on a nearly universal character, and we get, again, another pattern that's a pattern of meaning that comes out of these symbols. To summarize this, it goes like this. The poem is a dialogue between a work of art, which is the Sylvan historian, and an observer, in which the observer undergoes a transformation based on the pattern of thought that takes him gradually from a consideration of bliss captured for eternity to passion captured in cold stone, to priestly sacrifice that leaves the town empty. The train of thought leaves the narrator to answer his own question posed at the start and speak for the vase, saying that we cannot know exactly what the history or story of the vase is. What we know only is the frozen beauty, or the beauty of this frozen moment, and yet we know that this beauty is true also. And he is saying it is all we can or need to know. At this point, it's almost like a philosophical argument. But the point is that now we have these three layers overlaid on one another, the literal level and the sound image being on one level, the figurative level being a level of feeling on another level, and then the symbolic level, which is more like the philosophical level at the deepest level of the poem. And all three of these are what combine to create that holistic image that is the poem. It reminds me of this, which is the brain, basically, and the network of self. It's a network. Every one of the literal words interlocks with other words to create a meaning. Every feeling interlocks with the other feelings to create a meaning. Every idea interlocks with the other ideas to create another meaning, and the levels together interact to create a full experience. So let's read the poem one more time. Do you think we could read it together? Would it create two? Do a choral reading? That would create chaos. Okay, so if you'd like to read along, you can. You can at least mouth it. It's fun because the sounds in this roll off the tongue and echo one another and ebb and flow. It's a beautiful kind of sound image. So, Ode on a Grecian Urn. Thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, sylvan historian who canst thus express a flowery tale more sweetly than our rhyme. What leaf-fringed legend haunts about thy shape of deities or mortals or of both? In Tempe or the dales of Arcady, what men or gods are these? What maidens loathe? What mad pursuit? What struggle to escape? What pipes and timbrels? What wild ecstasy? Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. Therefore, ye soft pipes, play on, not to the sensual ear, but more endeared, pipe to the spirit ditties of no tone. Fair youth beneath the trees, thou canst not leave thy song, nor ever can those trees be bare. Old lover, never, never canst thou kiss. Though winning near the goal, yet do not grieve. She cannot fade, though thou hast not thy bliss. Forever wilt thou love, and she be fair. O happy, happy boughs that cannot shed your leaves, nor ever bid the spring adieu. And happy melodist, unwearied, forever piping songs forever new. More happy love, more happy, happy love, forever warm and still to be enjoyed, forever panting and forever young, all breathing passion far above, that leaves a heart high, sorrowful, and cloyed, a burning forehead and a parching tongue. Who are these coming to sacrifice? To what green altar, O mysterious priest, leads thou that heifer lowing at the skies, and all her silken flanks with garlands dressed? What little town by river or sea shore, or mountain built with peaceful citadel, is emptied of its folk this pious morn? And little town, thy streets forevermore will silent be, and not a soul to tell why thou art desolate can e'er return. O Attic shape, fair attitude, with breed of marble men and maidens overwrought, with forest branches and the trodden weed, thou silent form dost tease us out of thought, as doth eternity, cold pastoral. When old age shall this generation waste, thou shalt remain in midst of other woe than ours, a friend to man to whom thou sayest, beauty is truth, truth beauty, that is all ye know on earth and all ye need to know.
Is there more there this time than last time? So here's the wholeness then. A wholeness emerges from the multiple layers of meaning overlaid on one another, reflecting ultimately the movement of the mind on all these levels, including the change that occurs in knowledge over the five stanzas. We're transformed, in other words, in the poem. Including the ricocheting attention from concrete to abstract, from literal to figural to symbolic. The meaning of the poem is the journey the mind makes in sound, story, imagery, and argument. And all layers and pieces of layers derive their meaning from this whole that we just read. It looks a little bit like this on a unified field chart, that meaning is an integration of surface levels with depth, subject with object. It is that network, that fabric of all of these interlocking pieces that I mentioned. And the pieces, the words in the poem, the images in the poem, the ideas in the poem derive their meaning from this whole. But it's not just in literature. I feel this is true in many different disciplines. In the periodic table, for example, of the elements. How do we understand an element? We understand it in part by the family to which it belongs, which is determined by the electron shells around the nucleus. We understand it by the rows, which are also one added electron at each step. So it's part of that family. And we understand it even more deeply when we understand how they interact with each other, because some elements react very spontaneously and strongly with one another, others don't. And so we understand, again, the parts here by a vision or understanding of the whole. Here's another big one. This is the phylogenetic tree of life, where you can see fungi at one point, animals in another, plants at another, and protista at another. And all of them are connected by, of course, their DNA. So there again, the understanding any species is only possible in light of the whole from which each species emerges in the process of evolution. And so,
And now the last thing is the role of consciousness-based education is basically to show the way out of the cave and into the sunlight, in the sense that what the unified field chart, just as a representation here, does is it helps you see the part in relation to the whole and where the whole is to be located that brings meaning to each of the parts. And that brings us back to the final sort of theme, which is wholeness alone gives strength to the parts of knowledge. We cannot even know a part of knowledge without knowing the whole from which it derives its meaning. And finally, the reminder of the fact that we all want to get out of the cave. So that's all I wanted to say. I apologize if this tour through the poem is a little quick, but I think you get the point. And now I'll let the others respond to that.
Thank you, Dr. Jones, for helping my understanding in such a profound way. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Boothby. Dr. Sam Boothby received his BA from Kalamazoo College, his master's degree in education from Marish University of Management, and his Doctor of Education degree in Teaching, Curriculum, and Learning Environments from Harvard University. On the faculty of MUM, he served as Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Dean of Faculty, and Dean of Teaching and Learning. He has been a member of the Maharishi Vedic Science Department for 25 years, where he currently teaches graduate courses in Maharishi's Theory of Human Development through Higher States of Consciousness and Philosophy of Science. He also helps with administration and assessment of the undergraduate general education curriculum. His current area of research is in best practices in teaching critical thinking. Dr.
Liu. Oh, yes, sir, you can use it. Please get this.
Well, I was particularly struck by the beginning of this talk that Chris organized around these quotes from Maharishi, but particularly the quote, "Wholeness alone gives strength to the parts of knowledge." In that quote, the word that really strikes me is the word strength, that wholeness adds something more to the parts of knowledge when the parts are situated within the wholeness. One of the things we know about university education is that it's all about parts, even within the organization of the institution itself. Life is a wholeness. Life is an ecology. But in order for the waking state intellect to understand that wholeness, it needs to operate in a linear fashion. And so we divide that wholeness of life up into all the different disciplines that we study. If we're talking about the sciences, we may divide it into all these different layers. Biology on the molecular and surface level of life, the cellular level of life, chemistry on the molecular and atomic level, and then physics on the atomic and subatomic levels. Everything that we're looking at around us in this room contains all of those layers and are holistically connected together. But in order to understand it, we dissect it. We look to all of the parts. If all that we do is to look to all the parts, then we're missing the life of what we're studying. And so one of the great insights that Maharishi gave to us and that he structured into consciousness-based education is to never forget the wholeness in which the parts are constituted. The wholeness is always more than the sum of the parts, first of all. And so that's one way in which we can understand the word strength in this quote from Maharishi. That more is the strength. The parts are by themselves are weak in some important sense because they're disconnected from life in some important way. And it's only when you put them together and understand their ecology, their interconnectedness, that you bring life back into the study. And that's what really gives the meaning. Chris also started out this talk by talking about that his research project involving this impulse he has always had to find greater meaning. In that phrase, the word greater is the one that I was particularly struck by. And when he asked me to speak at tonight's colloquium, I went through my own memory of teaching and tried to think of the best example I could bring to your attention of a situation in which Maharshi's explanation of wholeness brought greater meaning to a part that I would teach in the discipline. In this particular discipline is the discipline of philosophy of science. And so I just want to quickly go through an insight that I've gained from Maharshi's theory of higher states of consciousness with respect to a particular problem in the philosophy of science, which is called Hume's problem of induction. You're all, I'm sure, familiar with the two basic forms of logic, the first being inductive and the second being deductive. Inductive means that through a series of instances, through a series of discrete experiences, we generalize a principle. So the famous example in philosophy is that having seen a large number of white swans, one at a time, or in groups, on the Boston Common, then we generalized the principle that all swans are white. Now, deduction refers to the opposite process, whereby you deduce a particular instance that you could examine from a general principle. And the general principle, if we begin again with all swans are white, then we say, this bird is a swan. Then this bird must be white. Okay? Now, this relationship between deduction and induction is at the heart of the scientific method. The scientific method generally proceeds by way of testing hypotheses that are derived from theories that have a general theoretical principle at their heart. And if we were to take this same principle that we use in the example here, all swans are white, then science proceeds by, if this was something that someone thought up as a theory about the nature of reality, then science would proceed to try to verify whether or not this theory was true by testing through direct sensory experience whether or not the swans that they interacted with that they saw were white. And this is supposed to lend strength. It's supposed to increase our confidence. The more white swans we see, that the theory is correct, that the generalization is correct, that all swans are white. David Hume, who's a Scottish philosopher from the late 18th and early 19th century,
Same period,
that's right. Destroyed this idea that inductive tests of a theory lend strength to the test. And he did so for the following reason. Let's say that this line here represents all of the swans we've seen today, to date. So it's a series of each dot that makes up this line is a confirmatory experience that all the swans we've seen are white. There is nothing, Hume says, in logic that requires that the next observation that we're going to make is going to be the same as the past observation or present observations that we have made. There's nothing that logically requires. We can easily imagine a situation in which the next swan that we would see would be black. Okay. So this is represented by this being the next observation. In order to make the logical deduction that the next observation that we are going to make is going to be the same as previous observations that we have made, we have to assume the uniformity of nature. Now, assuming the uniformity of nature is exactly what science does all the time, and it's the reason that science has been so successful to date in explaining how nature works and what the laws of cause and effect are that we observe operating around us. But the problem from the perspective of logic is that if you are assuming the uniformity of nature is what's called circular reasoning. You're trying to prove the uniformity of nature by a series of inductive or specific observations. You can't prove it by assuming it. And so not being able to assume the uniformity of nature, there's no logical reason why the next observation has to be the same as any of the previous observations that we've made. I don't know if this is making sense to you, if you're following what I'm indicating here. Now, what we have here from the perspective of Maharshi Vedic science is a problem with time. Okay? What we have here is a problem with how we experience time in the waking state. We don't have access to the future in the waking state. We have access to the present. We may have a record of the past, but we have no access to the future. It's a feature of the waking state. It's a feature that Hume is indicating, actually, in the problem of induction, that we don't know what the future is, and it could be anything. And I want to point out to you here that even if we were to assume the uniformity of nature, Hume's problem would still exist for us. Because if we take it from the perspective of time, okay, it could be that even if nature is orderly and uniform, our observations to date may not have taken into account over the larger expanse of time what the nature of that orderliness actually is. The next observation we make could be completely at odds with the previous observations we have made, but simply be part of a larger pattern that which unfolds over a longer period of time. So what wholeness does Maharshi provide us that gets us out of the problem of induction? Basically, the wholeness that's available to us is eternity, the eternity that Keats referred to in his poem. Access to a level of consciousness for which the past, present, and future is not a restriction. We're not restricted from traveling anywhere we want in time or space. According to Maharshi's theory of higher states of consciousness, when we're established in the field of the absolute, which is beyond time or space, and operating from the level of the finest relative level of life, which is the first manifestation of time and space, we can travel anywhere we want at will. It's a feature of higher states of consciousness. We can know anything we want to know, one thing at a time, in higher states of consciousness. And that means we can know anything we want to know, one thing at a time, about the future, as well as about the past. Once we remove the restriction of time, we remove the problem of induction. But that removal of the restriction of time is only available literally on the level of wholeness of consciousness, not on the level of the restricted value of the parts of consciousness, which are characteristic of the waking state. Anyway, that's a little bit different angle on this idea of meaning becoming strengthened or gaining new insights into traditional problems, for example, in the philosophy of science, by bringing the knowledge of wholeness, which was gained through consciousness-based education, not just both theoretically and experientially, to a particular problem in a field. I don't know if that's interesting.
I want to refer to the work of a mathematician who was also early 19th century and lived to the age of 21, and nevertheless is regarded as one of the 10 greatest mathematicians who ever lived, and that's Évariste Galois, not a common household name. He is the first one that introduced the mathematical study of symmetry. And we all know the idea of symmetry. But for a mathematician, it can get very deep and very involved. And I don't want to get into it. But I do want to say something about symmetry in the way I'll be talking about it. If you think of a square, it's symmetric. I think you all agree with that. And what makes it symmetric is all four corners are exactly the same. Each corner looks exactly like the other one. Each side of the square looks exactly like the other sides of the square. And in fact, a square, we would say, is an example of fourfold symmetry. So, that's the example of symmetry. Galois was using the symmetry of roots to an equation, and that's irrelevant here. But what he was doing was he was looking at the abstract principles that govern symmetry. Now, I'll be using this as an example as I continue. Dr. Jones was talking about meaning. And the very famous 20th century mathematician David Hilbert, I'm sure you've heard of him in the context of Hilbert space, he's very famous for talking about how mathematicians want to get rid of meaning. And so when you were talking about the value of meaning, I was thinking about how am I going to relate that to this idea that mathematicians want to get rid of meaning. So let me tell you what get rid of meaning is. And really, it's one of these things where if you stop focusing on the parts, or you know the parts, but you're not focusing on them. If you look for something deeper, something more holistic, then you really get the real meaning. But most of you would have studied Euclidean geometry in high school. Even if you didn't know that's what you were studying, it was Euclidean geometry. And Euclidean geometry had a few very basic principles, points, lines, the relationships between them. And then you deduced everything from a few principles. Euclidean geometry was very deductive, so we didn't know what deduction is. And the principles, because you're a mathematician, you can just say what principles you want. So you could just lay out these principles and then deduce everything from those principles. At that time, and for about 2,000 years, everyone believed, mathematicians, scientists, philosophers, that Euclidean geometry was absolute truth, that it was the truth about the world we live in, it was the truth about how the mind functioned, the mind could perceive only according to Euclidean geometry. It was believed that Euclidean geometry was the absolute truth.
In the late 19th century, mathematicians discovered there were equally valid geometries that were very, very different from Euclidean geometries. The two names were elliptic and hyperbolic, and those are not so important, but if you've been following some of the studies in cosmology, people wonder now, today, what is the shape of the universe? It's not a given that it's the shape of Euclidean geometry. It may be these other shapes. At any rate, in the early 20th century, mathematicians had come to the conclusion that mathematics was not that Euclidean geometry was not absolute truth. And this was really a huge revolution in the way people thought about mathematics. It, it didn't quite get the public recognition or press that the change from classical physics to quantum physics got, because it was so much more abstract and more difficult to explain. But mathematicians saw that depending on what principles you assumed, you could deduce very different things. And more than just that, mathematicians were able to show that these three systems, Euclidean geometry, elliptic, and hyperbolic, and those names don't, you don't need to understand what those names imply to understand that mathematicians had come up with three completely different things that were quite puzzling to them, but when they saw, and this was very late 19th century, when they saw that they were all equally valid, the way they did that was create one system that could include all three simultaneously. They realized that mathematics wasn't talking about things the way they were. They were talking about, well, if you have these assumptions, you can get these conclusions. So mathematics, in its deductive way, is saying, well, you give us these assumptions, well, you can get these conclusions, but there's no absolute set of assumptions that you start working with. Hilbert really believed there was absolute truth, and he said, we must know what this absolute truth is, and we will know what this absolute truth is. We just have to keep probing more deeply in mathematics. We're all blessed to have discovered an absolute truth. Transcendental consciousness is an absolute level of life in which differences are completely harmonized. These different kinds of geometries could be harmonized in a way, but you were always working in one or the other, so they weren't like that. Now, what Hilbert did was, he said, well, mathematics really doesn't have meaning. He said, Euclidean geometry is about points and lines, and you have general principles about points and lines. Two lines intersected a point. Two points determine a line. You all know these things from high school. And you have these principles, and then you can keep deducting more and more and more. And it's really incredible how much mathematics can be deduced from five or six general principles. Now, what Hilbert said was that those general principles really weren't about points and lines, because after all, what are points and lines? He said they could be about, and use the example of a table and mug. They were probably in a German restaurant at the time. And he said if you related the properties to these things, everything you deduced would be true about them. And he said that really mathematics doesn't have meaning. And most mathematicians accept this because, you just start with these things, points, lines, even numbers. And why is mathematics valuable? Well, mathematics is valuable because one can give meaning to these things. So we've proved all these theorems. And then you say, and particularly the sorts of theorems Galois has proved, he proved all these things about symmetry. Well, somebody who's trying to solve equations, because you can use his principles. Somebody who's trying to design patterns, to design symmetrical patterns, can use his principles. String theory uses his principles. You've heard of the symmetries of strings. In fact, most of physics is all regarded as just a matter of understanding symmetry today. So what has happened to mathematics is the meaning has gone out. And mathematicians will tell you that. We're just talking about undefined terms. We use a word, but we don't know what it means. And the amazing thing is that is just completely delightful to do that. You're just working with abstract patterns of things that don't have any meaning to you. So, you know, I was thinking, well, Dr. Jones kept talking about meaning. What's going on? Because this meaninglessness of mathematics is so much fun. Well, what's happening, really? And, you know, of course, meaning has different meanings. And the meaninglessness of mathematics is when you have an undefined term. For example, even sets, you've all heard about set theory and so on. There's the idea of a set, and it has elements. Well, if you ask a mathematician what is a set and what is an element, they will say, well, those are undefined terms. We're not going to define them. All we'll tell you is their relationships. Sets contain elements. Elements can be in sets. Same with points and lines. They'll say, well, you know, in modern mathematics, we don't try to tell you what a point or a line is. We'll just tell you that lines are made up out of points. Two points determine a unique line. Two lines intersect at a unique point. And that's all you need to know.
All you know on Earth.
That's all you need to know. And, what's really happening here? And, you know, I kept thinking, how does this meaningless create meaning? Well, what's happening is, in mathematics, you're getting to a level where the meaning is very abstract and it's really just on the level of relationship. And it unifies, and this is the really beautiful thing about mathematics that just mathematicians love, is it completely unifies all the diversity on the surface. So the properties of strings, patterns like the pattern on the rug, solutions to equations. I could go on and on with all kinds of things that won't make sense to you. But all of these things can be understood using the symmetry groups of Galois. And so what really ends up being the case in mathematics is that by not insisting on the meaning of something, you generate a wholeness that can include, and here we've got parts, the parts of physics, biologists study symmetry, mathematicians study symmetry, geometers study it, algebraists study it, all these people study it. So by letting go of meaning, you generate a much, much bigger meaning. And so that's beautiful. And I just want to add one thing because of the way the poem ended so beautifully. Hardy, who is an extremely famous 20th century mathematician, said, "There is no place in mathematics for that which is not beautiful." And sometimes you have to be a mathematician to understand that, but that's what keeps us going, really, is the beauty. And the beauty comes from functioning at deeper levels of consciousness. Thank you.
Thank you for helping us understand the deep level of mathematics. So this is fascinating.